All right, well, everyone's on the line, and let's welcome you all to Veganpalooza 2012 Vegetarian World Summit. I'm your co-host, Steve Prusak, and let's get ready to introduce our next guest. And we'd like to welcome to Veganpalooza Keith McHenry, co-founder of the worldwide Food Not Bombs movement. He's considered one of the most effective food activists in the world, helping to feed countless thousands of hungry people nutritious plant-based meals through a revolutionary grassroots movement that is empowering positive social change in cities all over the planet. And to lead the call, let's welcome our friend and co-host, Dr. Will Tuttle.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's an honor to have with us now Keith McHenry, who's one of the co-founders of Food Not Bombs. And back in 1980 in Massachusetts, he was working with local people to help feed the hungry. And it's really great because it's vegan food. It's very often it's recovered food. It's food that wouldn't go to waste otherwise. And he has been doing this now, recovering, cooking, and sharing food with the hungry with Food Not Bombs for over 30 years. He was arrested for making a political statement in San Francisco, spent over 500 nights in jail, faced 25 years to life in prison for feeding the hungry. He spent 19 days in jail for sharing vegan meals in Orlando, which is a lot of cities are apparently passing laws making it illegal to feed large groups of food. And he's also an author. He's written the book Food Not Bombs, How to Feed the Hungry and Build Community. And he's also written and illustrated a book called Hungry for Peace, How You Can Help End Poverty and War with Food Not Bombs. He's traveled all over the world speaking at colleges, bookstores, community groups, and also sharing free vegan meals. And it's amazing to think of it, but there's over 1,000 local Food Not Bombs groups in North America, in Europe, in South America, in Asia and Australia. I mean, all over the world, there are Food Not Bombs groups that have spread like a wonderful network of love and support to help redistribute food from places where it would be thrown away to hungry people. So this is the man we have with us, and it's just really, as I say, we're just so pleased to have you with us here, Keith. And I wanted to start out here. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about what the issues are that you're working on now, because the landscape is always changing, and in some ways I guess it's getting a little more difficult perhaps to feed food to hungry people, but we just love to hear what you're working on now and anything else you'd like to tell us about the movement. I know you've got a rich history too, so probably be nice to hear about that. But what's happening right now?
Well, right now the principal issues facing Food Not Bombs are that a number of cities, as you had indicated, have started making laws against our sharing food. And it's interesting because they've boldly, like Houston and Dallas, Texas, Philadelphia, of all things, which is a city with a huge number of homeless people, Santa Monica made recently a new law that was aimed at restricting our meals there, Venice Beach. And this is basically all over Florida. It's a huge number of anti-outdoor food service laws that have been passed throughout the United States. And the most recent ones that we're worried about are the Houston and the Philadelphia laws. And any day now, we expect to hear that we are started to be arrested in those two cities. We've had some luck. They were threatening to arrest us several weeks ago in each case, and they haven't confronted us yet. In Houston, we've been sharing 4 days a week. Philadelphia, it's 3 days a week. It's vegan meals out on the street where people are passing by. We're outside the main library downtown Houston. We're at like three different locations in Philadelphia. And it seems that the authorities decided somehow, right around the beginning of the year, they started announcing that they're going to introduce these laws that used to limit us to sharing twice a year, something like that. But now it's to the point where it's out now banning us from providing food outside. That is really damaging for a lot of reasons, because one of the main goals is that you're just walking down the street and you happen upon a Food Not Bombs table, you see a bunch of people eating, you join in, and you discover that we are providing this wonderful vegan meal, and you have this experiential impact going, wow, this, what is this food? And it's because of that and the outreach that we're doing also about issues of hunger and poverty and why a plant-based diet would be the most effective direction to go in ending global hunger. You know, we just can't do that if we're inside a building someplace. And also, it limits us because we really are so grassroots. We're trying to do this without any money, or very little money. And if we had to start renting buildings and so on, that would become very difficult for our chapters. These are mostly young people. But most importantly, it would interfere with our First Amendment right to try to reach the community with the ideas around vegan food and the ideas around working for peace and social justice.
Right, and often Food Not Bombs are the only vegan choices for hungry people, and it's really, besides actually feeding them, which is so important, because especially with the economic downturn, there's a lot of people that are really going hungry, but it's also educational because it helps them to learn how they can actually make meals that are less expensive, more nutritious, won't lead to a lot of disease and in ill health and diabetes and so forth. So it's very interesting to me that instead of embracing you and thanking you for this wonderful service that you're providing, they're actually trying to stop you. I mean, how
Yeah, it's really outrageous. And as you say, like, you know, if you, you know, you come by Food Not Bombs often enough and you start to see that with that, you know, our food is organic often, it is recovered. But yeah, families could, and we give away free groceries as well, usually free organic produce, pretty high-end breads and pastries and things like that. What we're trying to teach people, like, rather than just get the donuts and mac and cheese and stuff that you mostly get at these, you know, at most food programs, you know, we're showing that the food is so dramatically different at the Food Not Bombs meal. And there are a surprising number of homeless and poor people that are vegan and have no other choices. Another issue that's really of concern to us that we have noticed over the years is that many women do not want to take their children to indoor soup kitchens because it's very loud and scary with all the diversity of people, many of them, emotionally challenged and so on, that can happen in these soup kitchen environments. And they would much more prefer to eat outside where you're kind of on equal basis with everybody. You can kind of get away to the, you know, to where you want to go, that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's just incredible that the government, and the only places that we're being harassed, like you say, is the United States. And coincidentally, we're also being bothered in Belarus, where we're being arrested every week there. And that's an overt, you know, dictatorship. So it's kind of shocking that the two countries that would be bothering us are Belarus and the United States.
Well, I guess that's a commentary on the state of our democracy right now. And it's important, I think, that people understand this and support the efforts that you're doing. I think besides, of course, going vegan, which I think is probably the best thing anybody can do, to become informed, to write to your legislators, and maybe you could talk a little bit about what actually, you know, might be behind some of this. What's actually, do you have any thoughts of that? I mean, laws are being passed?
I think there's two things. Kind of the more immediate problem for governments are that the Democratic Party, this is sad too, because, you know, you wouldn't think of this as being an issue of the Democratic Party, but the Democratic Party is trying to run in this new election under the, from the point of view that the economy is turning around. And so we have heard that the occupations, in particular, you know, last year, which we were involved in providing food for, are something that they don't want to have reoccur in advance of the election. And one of the things to do is to ban the food, and then it makes the occupations, you know, less likely to be sustained. And we've heard that through a couple of government officials who spoke about this to the media in each of these cities. And then, the other thing is that we believe that there's a broader even concern, not only that's just party-based and about getting elected, but about the whole way the society is organized, where people are, that there's definitely going to be a dramatic increase in hunger and poverty in between now and the election and maybe, you know, and definitely beyond. And that this could lead to some type of social unrest and so on. And that therefore, if there's people outside with food that are talking about working together in community and collectively, then it might make it more difficult for the authorities to manipulate populations, drive them to areas where they want them to be, withhold food for people that are not going along with their program, and to reward people with food if they move to different locations. And I just drove across the United States from the NATO protests after having, I had like an amazing spring. I was in Ethiopia, and I'm now in correspondence every day practically with the Food and Bonds volunteers from Addis Ababa, and that's just amazing. I just actually talked to some kids from Nairobi just before getting online, and what they're doing there. It's just incredible. But then I came back, went to provide food with Seeds of Peace, another kind of sister organization at NATO in Chicago, and I came across, and you could see that the corn was already in trouble. And I also was listening to, in Iowa and in Nebraska, you would hear these reports about genetically modified corn crops failing, and that there was that was a crisis. And that, and I was pretty astounded that a local NPR station would talk about that, because that's, of course, a major concern is trying to end GMOs, which is one of the leading causes of hunger. But then the other thing that started to make the news in the last few weeks with the forest fires and all the stuff that's going on with that is people are starting to speculate in food, and that the prices could, because of the droughts, the fires, the failed crops due to the use of genetically modified seeds and activator chemicals and so on, is going to lead to a giant increase in food prices, much more dramatically than what people had predicted before. Last year, the UN predicted the food prices would double in 10 years. This could be, spark social unrest in a major way. And so I think all of these things are together in this. And I know that we saw with Katrina that there was concern that we were sharing, providing the meals to the survivors there, because there was an effort to drive people out of that region. And by our continuing to feed the people there for 8 months after the hurricane, you know, it disrupted those plans. And I would not be surprised if they're not, you know, they already are predicting higher food prices, more civil unrest, increased foreclosures, more homelessness and poverty, and that any kind of movement like ours, where we're sharing food in 500 cities in the country, needed to be, suppressed as much as possible.
Wow, that is so amazing. That's fascinating. I hope everybody understands really what you're saying there, but that there's a really forces within the so-called authorities and the government that are trying to actually, in many ways, control people more egregiously, and that food is one way that's being done, and not allowing us to feed each other. I know this has been some banning of people growing their own gardens and that kind of thing, too. And I think it's very important, obviously, to understand that genetically engineered seeds and crops are not only devastating to the ecosystems, but they're really primarily for feeding animals who are then killed or milked or whatever to get animal foods, which is enormously wasteful and is a direct driving force behind world hunger, because we could easily use that land to grow healthy food for people. This is, to me, what you're doing is, it's almost like the microcosm of the whole situation, and you're facing it. You're facing being repressed. You're facing having your efforts to feed people free vegan food be repressed. And I think a lot of people would like to know, where do you get, when you say you recover this food is recovered, you get this vegan food and you distribute it to people and you help feed them, but where does it actually come from for the most part?
Well, what we have done for the whole 32 years, and I actually, this is how I came across this idea, was I myself was a produce worker in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I was hired to be like the manager of the organic produce department and in a natural food store, which is sort of Bread and Circus, and I was surprised at how much produce, you know, went out the door, was discarded. So I started taking it to the housing projects down the street, and across the street from where I was bringing this food turned out to be a huge modern building, and they were designing the guidance system for intercontinental nuclear missiles, and hence that's where we got the name Food Not Bombs, because, you know, less than 100 yards away there were people that were going hungry while there were people spending huge amounts of money trying to figure out how to send a missile from the United States to the Soviet Union. And that over 40% of the food, or an estimated $100 billion worth of food, is thrown away is thrown away in the United States every year. And, you know, this is really tragic when you consider so many people are going hungry. And a lot of the it kind of works for us in a certain way. The commercial stores, like the big giant Safeways and stuff like that, they tend to never give us any food. But their food actually is not organic anyway. So, you know, there's still tons and tons of produce and you know, really nice breads and so on that you can recover from natural food stores or from produce warehouses. Every city has a section of produce warehouses where you can go in the morning early and get actually discarded cases of organic melons and organic, you know, lettuce and all of that. And then the other thing is farmers markets now are increasingly donating to Food Not Bombs. And that's often really local organic produce and organic breads and so on from the, you know, made by local wheat and barley and so on in the local grains. So, this, you know, it's the way food is. It's perishable. And the more nutritious food is, the more perishable it is, because, you know, if the bacteria want to eat it, then, you know, it's worth eating. And so, you know, that's why we recover that food mainly. And it's just go in and talk to the produce worker and say, hey, you know, you point to the bin below their cart. You know, they'll have a case of apples on top and a box full of you know, discarded stuff in the bottom. And it's just miraculous what you can make out of it. I mean, you know, every day that I cook, I just, you know, I get food here at Sid's, the natural food store in Taos. And I only got like two cases of, you know, all kinds of random leaves like bok choy and stuff like that. And we had a huge fruit salad, an amazing stew, and we added some organic Lundberg rice to it as a, you know, base. Unbelievable meal. People were freaking out. And, I mean, it's every time, every you know, we did that day after day, and it's just incredible that you can do that with so little ingredients. And then the larger cities, of course, you have much more available. So, and, you know, needless to say, many more people need it. You know, and there's a recent statistic showing, like, this part of our goal is there's really no reason for all these people living on the streets and being so desperate for food. We have all this food, and at the same time, there's estimates between, you know, in the area of like 5, and I've seen as high as 18 or even higher empty foreclosed homes for every homeless American. So you have all these people living outside in this incredible heat while houses are sitting empty, you know, all throughout their neighborhood. And all really, you know, not for no fault of their own. You know, people, I mean, the stories I hear almost every day of, you know, hardworking families, people that I presume were professional, you know, writers and things like that, that in my community who turned out they actually lost their home because of the failing economy. And also that's put stress on families. I've met so many people that have been getting divorced due to the economic pressure of trying to go through, survive a foreclosure. You know, and this is very painful to be seeing all these people suffering in a land which could have abundance, and but instead we take our soil and destroy it through this monocrop farming and this whole, you know, all the chemicals that we're putting in through the GMOs and stuff. And, you know, and we're just like, you know, we're basically doing, you know, allowing these large transnational corporations to totally trample our rights and you know, they're hijacking our government and the elections, and it's just stuff that we need to really organize around and try to turn around. And I think it's growing more and more urgent every day. I mean, it's hard to imagine people can really say there's no climate change when you look at the fires in this region where hundreds, well, it looks probably several thousand houses now have been burned up in the Colorado, New Mexico region. So,
yeah, right. You're in Taos right now. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think there is. It does seem to be that there's somewhat of a predatory quality about a lot of these corporations, the banks, the large banks, the pharmaceutical industry, a lot of the big food industry. There, it's like they make more money when there's more chaos and when there's more hunger, when there's more disease. And so there's really, in a way, there's no incentive to have, from their point of view anyway, and they have so much money and power to have healthy communities and healthy people. They make so much more money on people who are sick or people who are willing to fight wars and so forth. I think, you know, no, like, for example, in our case, I haven't given any money at all to the medical establishment, I don't think, in almost 40 years. And being a vegan, I think, is one of the great ways that we can understand, not only understand, but actually do something in a positive way to help create an alternative system. And it seems like that's what you're doing. These people, what kind of people are they typically who are setting up and running day in and day out over 1,000 Food Not Bombs groups? I mean, who are these people anyway that are just doing this selfless service? They're not getting paid. They're just showing up. They're working. They're feeding people. They're not. They're able to collect food, you know, without money. You don't have to do fundraising. I mean, you're free from fundraising. You're really so creative and so brilliant. And I'd like to know, who are these people that are doing all this?
Well, it's incredible. They are primarily high school and college age kids. And,
yeah.
And they've kind of come across it in a number of ways. One of the most common ways Food Not Bombs, the people are like punk bands and going to concerts and things like that, and then running into like a band will promote the Food Not Bombs from the stage, or they'll have information on their table at the concert. Then I speak at colleges. That's really helped. And, of course, once the Internet and the web got going, you would see people at first, that whole MySpace wave that went on, that was incredible. But so the majority of the people are in their, you know, are teenagers and young adults. Although, you know, many young adults now are becoming, you know, getting older and older and still doing Food Not Bombs. And I think that that's pretty miraculous because, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, people, you know, start to have families and jobs and so on. And they would sort of, you know, move on from, a lot of amazing people that you might know, you know, in the vegan world, got their start at Food Not Bombs, and then went on to start restaurants and wrote cookbooks and did you know, cooking shows and things like that. But in more recent time, the young people end up, they just keep doing phenol bombs because they don't end up getting a job. Things don't, you know, really turn around in their personal life in that way where they would be moving on. And they just stay increasingly more dedicated as they see their friends and family, you know, relying on phenol bombs to survive. And also all the different things that are going on in society, you know, they learn about stuff like GMOs or they learn about factory farming, you know, the new all the documentaries that come out or, you know, and keep educating people about what's happening with our environment and all the different like crazy things that are happening. And so they become super dedicated. Most recently I was down in El Paso, Texas, and the phenol bombs activists there, they work on both sides of the border, Juarez and in El Paso, and they actually have a movie night at one of the apartments where they cook, where they all come together to watch documentaries about different issues. So they're reading like crazy, all kinds of books, having study groups. So they're essentially becoming self-educated. They can't afford to go to college a lot of times anymore because of all the student loans and all the problems with that. So it's sort of like a miniature underground university of young people who are actually beyond just studying these things, but are actually putting their ideas into practice by volunteering with Food Not Bombs and starting their own chapters. And when we say it's 1,000 chapters, we really don't know. It could be way more than that. We just kind of generally know that there's roughly 1,000. But, I mean, every day I just get email from somebody doing Tulsa Food Not Bombs. And, like I say, I found new chapters in Africa recently. Unbelievable. Tasmania, a new chapter in there. And, of course, Iceland is still happening. I run into South African kids recently. And Russia is just, it's overwhelming, the number of chapters that are in Russia. It's like hundreds of chapters in Russia.
You know, it's so great. It's almost, it's a leaderless revolution. You don't have a top-down hierarchical model. It's just everybody working together, like in a big garden, just everybody plants the seeds and things come up, and you don't have a boss you have to report to. You know, the idea is liberating. I remember it was Gandhi who said, someone who says that politics is not spiritual does not understand either politics or spirituality. And one of the things I really love about Food Not Bombs is you're not only just serving food, you're also, as part of the table, I believe you have some literature to help people understand the political ramifications of this and why we're having inequality and why we're having a lack of food and so forth. Isn't that right? You have that as well?
It's quite fascinating. I'm actually this afternoon was writing a flyer, rewriting this flyer I have had on this very concept. So for up until 1997, there was never a Food Not Bombs table that didn't have a literature and a banner with it. But the government, and part of their repression in the United States, have actually tried to intimidate young people into not bringing literature and banners out to the meals, or have infiltrated the local chapters, and where they realize if they throw away the literature and the banner, then that's what they volunteer to do, is to be the people bringing out the literature and the banner, and then they discard it. And then people just, after a while, they lose track of the fact that that was important, and then diminish the number of people eating with them. It's very fascinating. So on the most recent book tour in the spring, I showed up at a number of Food Not Bombs groups where there was no literature, there was no banner, and they were in the center of a park where no one was walking by. And so I get to talking to them and try to find out how this all happened. And they go, well, this guy helped us out. And then we never saw him again, but we also never saw the literature and the banner again. We don't know where it is. And after a while, we forgot about it. And I had a number of the volunteers in cities say, how can we get more people? You know, we have a lot of people, we've lost numbers of people. And I would note, I'd point out, I'd say, look, actually, when I came to the park myself to find you, I thought maybe you were a church group, or maybe you were going to play Ultimate Frisbee or something, and there was no way to tell if you were really a Food Not Bombs. In fact, in one case, I helped cook all afternoon, and then because I needed to go speak at a cafe afterwards, I took my vehicle to the park without, you know, while the other kids came behind, and I went and sat with a group. It turned out they were a protest against police brutality. They weren't Food Not Bombs. They marched off someplace, you know, and then another group was sitting in another part of the park. It turned out they were Food Not Bombs, but you really couldn't tell, you know, and that's when one of the discussions I had there is, you know, was what some, one of the volunteers there about, like, you know, if you did have a banner and you have literature, you would become a festival, and you would then more people would come, and they would start discussing these ideas. And I've actually personally seen, for instance, I was in Iceland, and Food Not Bombs there, even though it's like bitter cold, they had literature, they had signs all around their table, and as a result, at one, people started having this conversation about what was going on with the banking industry and the problems that their society was having, inspired by the literature that was at the table. And eventually they started marching from the Food Not Bombs meal to the Parliament building every Saturday after the meal. And pretty soon those marches became so huge that the government was toppled. And then they're currently now rewriting their constitution using a crowdsourcing technique, you know, with the internet and so on. And, you know, it's transformed their society totally. And not that Food Not Bombs was the only thing that happened, but those Saturday marches, which became the revolution, would have never happened if there hadn't been literature and signs at the Food Not Bombs meal that inspired the original conversations that became the marches of people who otherwise were never politically active.
Wow. And that's in which country?
That was Iceland. Yeah, Reykjavik, Iceland.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, Iceland was the country that really was able to stand up to the big banks. I think people maybe don't even know that. It was the whole thing was repressed in the media here in the United States, but it's just fascinating to find that Food Not Bombs was behind, in some way behind that. I didn't know that. That's really interesting. Wow, thanks so much for sharing that.
It blew my mind. I happened to be going there on my way to a conference on discarding, you know, collecting discarded food in England, and the cheapest way to get there was to go to Iceland, so I hung out in Iceland for a while, and it was just amazing to see that with my own eyes, you know, everybody there, like, said, yeah, that's what happened. We, you know, and I went to the meals a couple of times, and they always became a march at the end of the meal. And, the occupations, Food Not Bombs was super involved in both the General Assemblies in advance of the Wall Street action, the original one on September 17th, but also at many other, in fact, we ended up, I was so overwhelmed. I was helping do Occupy Wall Street. I helped organize the kitchens in Washington, D.C., at both McPherson Park and Freedom Plaza. And then I'd go all over. The Food Not Bombs, actually, it was at Occupy Boston, was sharing food at the place of the very first major protest that we organized that was we did a soup kitchen in protest of the banking policies of the Bank of Boston, saying that they could lead to an economic crisis if they continued. And that meal was on March 26, 1981, and it just was amazing to be with thousands of people at the exact same address, protesting the same issue, but this time it was called Occupy Boston. And it's just amazing. 30 years later.
Yeah.
The only thing remaining besides the actual Federal Reserve Bank itself, which was across the street, was this one little yellow fire hydrant, which is where we had tied our tent to when on the very first action, and that was still there. It was really funny.
30 years ago. Wow, yeah. It's interesting. Yeah, that's fascinating. It just continues on, and I just think the point you were making earlier, too, was that there's been quite a conscious effort by, I guess, whoever, the FBI, perhaps, to infiltrate Food Not Bombs to try to take it apart from the inside by having people who are actually government agents posing as Food Not Bombs people and sowing discord and getting people away from the actual purpose of Food Not Bombs. But I guess that's a sign that you're being successful.
Yeah, one of the more outrageous things most recently was, we were involved in trying to promote a nonviolent, actions on May 1st at the occupation. We were trying to restart the occupations. And it turned out the FBI had joined the Food Not Bombs in Cleveland and tried to get some two of our volunteers to bomb a bridge outside of Cleveland. And the night of on April 30th, they arrested five people. Two of them were the people that were, members of Cleveland Food Not Bombs. But we've seen that numerous times. There was also the RNC-8. Those are Food Not Bombs volunteers that were cooking with Minneapolis Food Not Bombs before the Republican National Convention. And they were faced with the Patriot Act. And then another volunteer helped. I worked with him and his co-defendants in Philadelphia at a protest against genetically modified foods. And we held a national gathering in the days leading up to the biotech protest. Those three people got framed, got accused of plotting to bomb a dam in California on their vacation after the gathering. And one of them, Eric McDavid, got 20 years in prison. He's still in prison in California right now. And many of the so-called ELF, ALF terrorists that people might have heard about were either originally approached by the FBI while volunteering with Food Not Bombs or somehow became, through their work in part as being in Food Not Bombs, became targeted by the government, and needless to say, in most cases, the volunteers had they were in Food Not Bombs, right? They were not trying to do anything at all, but they would the government would create these entire plots around them and pay people to do stuff, and then try to pin it on our volunteers. Now, fortunately, most of us have gotten off. Including myself, I was accused of assault, battery, strong arm robbery, assault with a deadly weapon, and possession of stolen property in a three strikes case. The first, I was the first white person to face that in California in '94. So, there's been a long history of trying to do that to Food Not Bombs activists to try to discredit us and to frighten people away from our movement. But the actuality, it's just kept making us stronger and stronger. People see that the government is that focused on trying to disrupt our activity, and they believe that, well, maybe what they're trying to do is working. And essentially, it's really simple. It's free food, free vegan meals out on the streets in public to the regular Americans or to whoever, whatever country you're in, to the regular population. And developing a meal where people are all discussing ideas. The literature is designed mostly to inspire this conversation and then to try to achieve like a community response. And some of the things that have grown out of Food Not Bombs are like Food Not Lawns, where we grow vegetables. The Food Not Lawns movement is really taking off. And there's
that's a great idea.
That's amazing. And then Indie Media, we made our own thing called Indie Media in 95 in San Francisco. And now that, it's got Indie Media centers all over the world. There's really, really free markets where we give out free things. The homeless hot jails where we take over abandoned buildings and rehouse people that have been evicted. And so all these little projects have spun out of the Food Not Bombs movement. And it's all from the conversation that occurs that's inspired by reading the flyers at the table and eating this food, which gets you talking about, wow, why is this food good? Something different about this food than all the other food we're eating when we go to other places. So the whole combined, thing of experiencing, it's experiential and hopefully inspiring, and it just keeps growing. It's just this, we have our world gathering this August in Tampa, Florida, on August 20th through 26th, before the Republican National Convention, and so we're going to discuss a lot of these ideas there and, you know, work together, talk about future plans of Funat bombs, and then I know we're going to be feeding the protesters at the Democratic Convention, and then I'm sure people are already gearing up for all kinds of actions, you know, that happen during the winter. You know, there'll be all kinds of things like that. And then I'll be speaking at the Animal Rights Conference in Washington, D.C. the first week of August. And mostly about police repression will be my topic there.
Well, I want to really thank you so much, Keith, for spending some time with us and giving us a glimpse into this amazing action that you're doing. You know, when you're talking about food, not bombs, you're talking about food, not lawns, which I think is a great idea to have gardens instead of just grass, and the idea of homes, not jails, with so many abandoned buildings that could be used. And I think in a lot of ways what Food, Not Bombs, you're doing is really the very heart and soul of what veganism is all about, which is essentially questioning the official stories of our culture that keep us enmeshed in competition and violence and war and conflict and lack, and focusing on abundance and sharing and cooperation and compassion, kindness, inclusivity, blessing the world rather than trying to get something for myself at the expense of others, and working together to help make a better world. There's plenty to feed everybody. I mean, you're feeding so many people on just what's thrown away, this incredible abundance of the earth, and actually being willing to take a stand for justice and freedom and equality. And even in your case, I know you haven't had time to talk about it, but you were arrested, I know, in San Francisco for feeding food to hungry people. You were actually subjected to some pretty severe torture by the police department in San Francisco, which I know you've written about as well. And, you know, these kinds of things, I think it's important for people to understand that each one of us can make a huge difference, and you're someone that I think really has done that, and it's really an honor for us to have you with us here on Veganpalooza 2012. Thanks so much, Keith. McHenry, for the incredible work you've
done. Yeah, that's so
really
cool. Well, thanks so much. Yeah, they can find out more at foodnotbombs.net, and there's more than likely a Food Not Bombs group in your community, but if there isn't one, you know, our main focus is on encouraging people to do Food Not Bombs, because it's through doing it that all these people get fed, all these people are introduced to vegan food, and that all these people are, you know, it's so empowering. You know, you could be really, you know, depressed to hear all the different crazy problems that are going on in society, but when you end up doing Food Not Bombs, it's so magical to take, you know, essentially food that would have been discarded, and by the end of the day feed hundreds of people with some miraculous tasty food. That's really uplifting. So to figure out, you know, to find out how to do it and to reach me and to organize a chapter or get involved in your local chapter, just you know, go to foodnotbombs.net and we'll be happy to help you out.
Great. Yeah, everybody, I'm hoping will remember that, foodnotbombs.net, and it's a way to feed people and do something. You know, very often we feel a sense of despair or bitterness about what's happening, but when we actually go out like you're doing and help feed people vegan food that's organic, unprocessed and healthy, it just that's building community from the ground up. So thank you so much. Steve, do you have any final comments or anything before we wrap it up here?
Well, the main focus really of Food Not, you know, if you get involved, it's about doing it, you know, and I think that you will find in doing Food Not Bombs, you know, as that you will make so many more friends, that you will really, it will really transform your life. And so, you know, not only, you know, will it transform your life personally, and you know, of course, that's a great benefit, but it's incredible to see how it changes so many other people. And so if if we're able to encourage food not bombs in every community, it helps not only, you know, just the, you know, food not bombs, but it's a way of supporting all the other activities that you care about. So if you're already, you know, volunteering with Farm Sanctuary or something like that, and you do food not bombs, you can have the Farm Sanctuary flyers on your table. If you're already doing, you know, whatever project you're already doing, food not bombs is a perfect addition to that, because it's a way for you to promote that, those ideas and those projects to the general public in your community, and at the same time share vegan food with them and introduce people, because so many people assume, you know, have no idea what we're talking about when we talk about vegan food and a vegan lifestyle. But when they come across the meal, you know, this totally introduces them to a whole world that they may never have come across otherwise, since it's this, you know, just a free meal on the street. So really, that I encourage everybody to get involved and to visit foodnotbombs.net. If you can contribute, you know, we don't need tons of money, but we can use some money. We're really low pressure fundraising operation here, but there's always things, you know, that we can, you know, if we did have more money, we would do even more things. So there's a way to donate online, and you can be a monthly contributor of like even $5 a month, things like that. And that's like so amazingly helpful. And, you know, we live outside so that we're like not spending any money on rent and everything. And we're doing that so that we can, you know, put all of our energy into getting, you know, bulk rice and beans and oats and pots and pans and cooking equipment and doing this project all the way out. We don't have, you know, paid staff people and an office space and all the normal stuff that you would find in many other projects. And that's so we can just be out on the street with the people, talking to them, and trying to turn things around. And then finally, you know, things are getting really, really dire. I think that particularly in the issue of hunger and poverty, and I think we're going to see a huge spike this fall in food prices, and then even in potentially in food shortages in the United States. And so I really hope people, you know, join us this summer in preparation for what could be a really massive effort to try to, you know, to feed an ever-larging number of hungry people this fall.
Right. Wow, this is really great. I encourage everybody to find out more, and this is really, like I said earlier, this is a great vegan outreach activity that we can all get involved with. So, Steve, do you have any last-minute thoughts or words?
Just ready to bring it to the end here. A noble cause, Keith. Thank you so much for being here. It's amazing who they choose to target in this country. It's very interesting. So thank you.
Crazy. Thank you so much. That's so cool.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for listening to this session of Veganpalooza 2012 Vegetarian World Summit. And again, a special thanks to our guest, Keith McHenry. The website, again, is foodnotbombs.net. And if you'd like a written word-for-word transcript and digital audio download of every session of the event, plus special helpful bonus gifts, go ahead and sign up for Veganpalooza VIP at veganpalooza.com/VIP or follow the link on the event scheduling page. We look forward to connecting with you in the next session, so stay tuned.